On March 29, 1973, the New York Times reported, "The last American troops left South Vietnam today, leaving behind an unfinished war that has deeply scarred this country and the United States." Actually, the damage ran deeper than anyone anticipated, and the experiences of that conflict continue to shape the American consciousness. In his latest book, University of Massachusetts Amherst history professor Christian G. Appy draws on a wide range of sources, popular fiction, music, movies, and official documents, to unpack the complicated legacy of that war. The book, American Reckoning, The Vietnam War and Our National Identity, is published by Viking. I'm very pleased that it brings Professor Appy to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
And you begin with the story of a man named George Evans who didn't believe that there was such a thing as a bad war. That's a fairly common idea in America, at least was at the time.
Yeah, it certainly was for that generation coming of age in the 1950s and early 1960s, really the heyday of American exceptionalism, this idea that we are forever a force for good and democracy in the world.
Against evil, but isn't that still an issue in the country today? Many conservatives have criticized President Obama because they feel he doesn't believe in American exceptionalism.
Right. I mean, in a way, the Republican concern about the president and the decline in faith in that creed, I think, demonstrates how fragile that creed has become in American culture. I mean, it seems impossible to run for higher office without paying homage to that creed, but it is much more beleaguered than it was back before the Vietnam War.
Is that a bad thing?
No, not at all. In my mind, it'd be a good thing to dispense with that faith. First, I don't think the historical record justifies it. Second, I think it stirs up more animosity in the world than friendship. And I don't think it's economically sustainable to continue to have our huge military imprint around the globe.
But it has justified a lot of wars, some that are a bit embarrassing, like the Mexican War.
Right. It goes back deep in our history, that's for sure.
You've laid out a roadmap from the end of World War II to our involvement in Vietnam. How did we get there?
How did we get from World War II to Vietnam?
Well, because most people associate Vietnam with, well, I guess it depends on how you see it, with Kennedy and then Johnson. Mm-hmm. But it started much earlier.
Much deeper, actually, and some of that, it really backs to the World War II, but that's quite complicated to discuss. Certainly the real beginning is our support for ongoing French colonial rule in Indochina and their bloody 8-year war against Vietnamese revolutionaries, which we bankrolled.
Now, we're talking about Eisenhower there, but he's the same man who ended the war in Korea and warned against reliance on the military-industrial complex. Was he sending out mixed messages?
Well, in that famous farewell address, I mean, he was on the way out the door, and it should be said that he presided over a great growth in that military-industrial complex, but I think he did at least recognize that in the wake of the Korean War, that the country was war-weary and didn't want to immediately get back into a land war in Asia. But he certainly was willing to try in a small way and relying on the CIA to put in place a non-communist ruler and to preside over the creation of a permanent non-communist country.
We injected ourselves into Vietnamese politics and actually didn't allow for a plebiscite.
Right. That is a crucial. I'm glad you brought that up because many Americans in the 50s, to the extent that they even knew where Vietnam was, tended to support the policy because they were told that this was in support of a budding democracy against aggressive communism. But in fact, the Geneva Accords that brought an end to the French Indochina War had, as you alluded to, actually stipulated that there should be nationwide elections in Vietnam to reunite the country, North and South. There was never intended to be a South Vietnam, and it was the United States that blocked those elections because Eisenhower well understood from his intelligence reports that Ho Chi Minh would have won, the communist leader of Vietnam would have won an overwhelming victory, maybe 80%.
So this is all part of Cold War politics. How influential was Winston Churchill's views?
Well, you know, there's a historical debate about whether or not Eisenhower really wanted to go intervene into Vietnam to help the French, rescue the French.
Were the French asking us to do it?
They were. And I think Eisenhower, in fact, goes to Winston Churchill and says, you know, we didn't stand up soon enough against fascism in Europe. This may be the same kind of situation now. What do you think? Churchill wouldn't buy it. He didn't see bailing out French colonialism as equivalent to standing tough to Hitler. So without that ally...
Despite the fact that his own empire was falling apart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, precisely. Yeah.
So, but we still started getting involved, at least in a non-combatant way, sending advisors and such. How early did people start speaking out against this?
Well, even in the 50s, in a very small way, there was some resistance, but not open public protest really until the mid-60s. The anti-war movement becomes this gigantic phenomenon, very wide-ranging and diverse and huge, but it takes many years to develop. It takes many years for Americans to become conscious of the distortions and flat-out lies they had been told about the origins of the war and the way it was being conducted.
But at the beginning, there were a lot of people who were signing up to go into the military, although there was a draft in place, mm-hmm. because they believed in the domino theory.
They believed in the domino theory, and I think also there was a real idealistic and even liberal underpinning to Cold War politics that inspired a lot of young people. I write a lot in the first chapter about a guy that's now long forgotten, but his name is Tom Dooley, who was a naval doctor who participated in an operation to try to bring northern, mostly Catholic refugees into South Vietnam with the idea to really build a constituency for the regime of Ngo Dinh Diem, who was the leader that we were supporting in the South. And he, John Kennedy, when he finally announced the creation of the Peace Corps, used Tom Dooley as an example of just the kind of service that he had in mind, as an exemplar of that. And Dooley was wildly famous as a kind of medical missionary, and wrote a famous book called Deliver Us from Evil, now forgotten, but was a bestseller that really talked about our role there as kind of a holy crusade to rescue these suffering and tortured victims of communist treachery.
We think of the 60s as the time when the anti-war movement was really strong, but on January 30th, 1966, the Ed Sullivan Show had a Green Beret medic, Staff Sergeant Barry Sadler, as a guest. He sang the Ballad of the Green Berets, and that song reached number one on the pop charts not long afterward.
In fact, it was the number one pop song of 1966, which really shows you, in a way, how well into the 60s there remains support for the American military and the assumption that it must be doing good in the world.
Well, there were all of these stories after the war of Americans spitting on returning GIs, but many people are upset today if anyone seems to even be slightly critical of soldiers and the military.
Yeah, one of the sort of strange legacies of the war is the growing sense in the 80s in particular and beyond that one of the most shameful aspects of the Vietnam War, maybe the most shameful, was not anything we did in and to Vietnam or anything about the war itself, but the shabby treatment of Vietnam veterans.
Were they treated shabbily?
Well, I think they were primarily by the government and corporate America.
Well, there was also PTSD affecting a lot of people, but at the time, the returning vets who suffered from PTSD were just being treated as though they were crazy people.
That's right. The stereotypes of Vietnam veterans in the 70s promulgated by the media were really crude and ugly, sort of this violence-prone, drug-addled, wacko vet would be a figure on the streets of San Francisco or the sort of popular TV shows commonly in that period.
My guest is Christian G. Appy. His latest book, American Reckoning, The Vietnam War and Our National Identity. How soon after the success of the Ballad of the Green Berets, there was also the John Wayne movie on Green Berets, did we start seeing a different kind of song show up on the pop charts?
Well, we'd already, even when that was a popular song, we had, the Beatles, the Stones, the whole
country,
revolution in music. So there were explicitly anti-war songs going back really to the early 60s. So there was a real cultural divide by the middle of the decade. But by the late 60s, It was almost unthinkable that on most rock stations, a pro-war, pro-military song would have been aired. So country music really fulfills the role of carrying on the sort of more flag-waving pro-war songs.
During the invasion of Iraq, many people pointed out that, or argued anyway, that the reason we weren't seeing the kinds of protests we'd seen with the Vietnam War was because there was no national draft. Do you think that is a major reason?
Well, it is a reason. That's for sure. I once polled my students at UMass and asked them how many had participated in some kind of protest, and very few hands went up. And then I asked them, well, if there were a draft and you might have to fight there, how many of you think you might engage in some kind of dissent? And quite a few more hands did go up. So I think it's a factor. It should be remembered that prior to the invasion of Iraq, there were protests in this country and many European capitals that were unprecedented in an effort really to prevent the war before it started.
A number of journalists have told me over the years that they went to Vietnam in support of the war. The people who were sending them were supporting the war. And while they were there, they became disillusioned.
Mm-hmm.
And were they partly responsible? Many people blame the press and the negative reports we were getting for the public's attitude changing.
My feeling, and this is borne out in most of the studies of the media during that era, is that the media was not really in front of the public in terms of being more anti-war than the public. It is true that it was ever present on the news. So, I mean, that does have its effect in at least bringing it to public consciousness.
And were getting live reports.
Well, not live until the very end of the war. They were taped and edited in New York, but they were seeing shots of the war itself. So it had its effect, but I think the media itself was really going hand in hand with the country and its turning against the war.
Although this is also a time of civil rights, and there's an interesting Time magazine article from May 26, 1967 called Democracy in the Foxhole, which praised the contributions of, quote, Negro fighting men as a hopeful and creative development in a dirty, hard-fought war, a chance for blacks to gain respect. They argued that the integrated military was a vindication of American exceptionalism. But then, in contradiction to the whole premise of the article, it talked of often inchoate and inconsistent, instinctively self-serving, yet naturally altruistic, the Negro fighting man is both savage in combat and gentle in his regard to the Vietnamese. The Negro's motives, he may fight to prove his manhood, perhaps as a corrective to the matriarchal dominance of the Negro ghetto back home.
Yeah, you're quoting from my book. It is appalling, really. But Time magazine was using the quote unquote good black soldier to really beat up on black dissidents at home, and did it quite explicitly.
Now, we came in with Bruce Springsteen. We're going to tell a little story about Bruce Springsteen later. But right now we're going to take a break. My guest is Christian G. Appy, professor of history at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, the author of two previous books on the Vietnam War, including Patriots, The Vietnam War Remembered from All Sides. This book is published by Viking, and we will continue after this. We're back with Christian G. Appy. His book, American Reckoning, The Vietnam War and Our National Identity, published by Viking. When the American people found out that the Gulf of Tonkin attack was used to escalate our involvement but was largely fabricated, and American soldiers were not always acting in a way that we might be proud of, things started turning around as well. Were the revelations of the My Lai massacre kind of the apex of that crisis?
I think so, at least in turning, raising a fundamental question that some had raised, but now a majority of Americans were required to ask, which is this war moral or immoral? In the past, many Americans had asked, is it practical? Is it winnable? Is it cost-effective? But now they're being forced to confront the possibility that we were acting as the bad guys in Vietnam.
But, of course, people act poorly in every war. We've heard of atrocities from the good guys in World War I and World War II. I don't know where we would ultimately stand in the Korean War, but there were atrocities there as well. So was this just more of the same because we were turning on the war itself?
Well, I do think many Americans made that precise argument. You know, this happens in all wars. All sides do it. But once you've made that concession, you are really sort of throwing out the window the idea that we're exceptional, that we place a higher value on life. And it wasn't, you know, My Lai was certainly exceptional in its scale, you know, a company going into a village and murdering roughly 500 unarmed, unresisting civilians. But our bombing policy, particularly in the South, it had some constraints in the North, but it was virtually unrestrained over the country that we claimed to be defending. I mean, we dropped 4 million tons of bombs on South Vietnam, and the rules of engagement allowed pretty free use, in addition to the B-52 carpet bombing that dropped about half of those bombs.
Why do you think we didn't have the same kind of major national debate when we learned of atrocities in Afghanistan and Iraq?
Well, that's a hard one. I do think it did stir up public concern, and I think in a way, unfortunately, many Americans have come to the conclusion that there's really nothing you can do about these things. They're not so shocked as I think they may have been in the 60s, and there is, I think, a growing feeling that the war-making machine is really impervious to public outcry and has a kind of life of its own that will go on. And clearly, Congress doesn't seem to be doing anything about it and hadn't since.
In Iraq and Afghanistan, I suspect the same thing happened in Vietnam. Everything was blamed on a few bad apples.
That's right. Every time, I remember vividly in the early 2012, there was a series of bad stories coming out of Afghanistan. There was the massacre of 16 civilians in Kandahar. Some troops burnt a large number of Koran. There were videotape and pictures of the soldiers urinating on corpses. And in the wake of each one of those instances, Obama and Hillary Clinton and other officials said the same thing. This is not who we are. This doesn't reflect on us as a people. And again, and just as you say, this is an aberration, an exception, a few bad apples. But, you know, when the instances pile up that much and go that deep in our history, this really is part of our record. This really is a part of who we are.
Then there are the bad apples at home. When the American people found out, in a chapter that you called The War at Home, you write about the Kent State University shootings happening on the heels of Nixon's announcement that he would gradually withdraw U.S. ground troops. But he said, after the students were killed, this should remind us all once again that when dissent turns to violence, it invites tragedy.
Yeah, in effect saying they got what they deserved.
And 58% of Americans polled after the shootings blamed them on the students.
Yeah, I think that that's true, though over time I think that figure certainly falls, in part because it was based on some initial reports coming out that proved to be false, this idea that there might have been sniper fire coming from the students and all other kinds of misinformation.
We have a number of people who've been writing in to our show. Fred from Queens writes, "It wasn't until the draft became universal that the war became so unpopular." Mm. Do you agree?
Well, they did make an important reform in the draft to replace it with a lottery system, which in theory could be much more perfectly random and fair. But that doesn't get introduced until the very end of 1969. And it's worth remembering that college student deferments lasted until 1971. And it was still a lot easier for privileged people to get into the Guard, which was not deployed, and to get physical exemptions.
Another listener, going back to earlier in the story, says that the Pentagon Papers included letters from Ho Chi Minh that were sent to Truman asking for protectorate status. Why were they kept under wraps?
The letters themselves? Or
yeah,
the response?
Well, does Vietnam really go back to Truman?
Yeah, absolutely. even to the end of World War II, when we had a brief two-week alliance with Ho Chi Minh and Vo Nguyen Giap. We dropped by parachute some OSS troops, predecessor to the CIA, to make contact with that anti-Japanese, anti-French force, and even gave them weapons and did some minor training of them. But after the war, Ho Chi Minh declared independence and really had high hopes that the United States might make good on its pledge embedded in the Atlantic Charter that self-determination should belong to all nations, rich and poor. And that's when Truman made a decision, a calculated decision, to side with the French. He was much more concerned about shoring up a European alliance in the Cold War that was already starting to develop, an anti-communist coalition. And if France wanted to go back into Vietnam and into all of Indochina and reconquer it, which is what they did, Truman supported it, first sort of covertly, but then by 1950 with open and massive aid.
My guest is Christian G. Appy, who is a professor of history at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. His latest book is called American Reckoning, The Vietnam War and Our National Identity. It's published by Viking. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Another listener, Crane Davis, writes, didn't the Army sentence Lieutenant Calley to life in prison for the My Lai massacre, although his sentence was reduced dramatically?
Yes, he did get that sentence, but Nixon made sure that he was offered parole after 3.5 years, and actually that 3.5 years he served was under house arrest, so it was pretty cushy confinement. And I think Nixon was reading the political tea leaves and understood that there was pretty broad sympathy for Calley. There were pro-Calley demonstrations, many of them in the more conservative parts of the country, but even people on the left believed that Calley was being used as a scapegoat because they understood that there were many more shooters at My Lai than just Calley. He became a lightning rod in the middle of this.
Well, Calley was blaming the higher-ups for mm-hmm. encouraging them to do that sort of thing.
But, of course, none of the higher-ups were ever convicted.
Many conservatives have argued that the Vietnam syndrome has handicapped U.S. involvement in foreign wars since. What are some of the symptoms of the syndrome?
Well, as defined by the political right, and Reagan was one of the first to use it, the Vietnam War had left the United States lacking in confidence, all too reluctant to exercise military power in the world. So this syndrome, this sort of disease-like phenomenon, was in their mind a weakness, a sort of new form of isolationism that had to be overcome. We had to rebuild the military. He vastly escalates the military budget. But beyond that, there's kind of a reconstruction progress to the American psyche. He really wants to rebuild pride and patriotism along with power.
He said it was okay to love America again. Mm-hmm. Many who were afraid to say that they loved America, I can't imagine that the ones who were ashamed of some of the things we had done were turned around by Reagan.
No, but even some of his own supporters, I think, did not accept Reagan's view that it was a noble war that should have been fought and could have been won. But I think even some of his supporters who thought the war was a mistake or unwinnable did really rally around this idea that it would be a good thing to resurrect patriotism and support the military.
Reagan had served in the military, but bad eyes prevented him from doing much. John Wayne, who made the Ballad of the Green Berets, did not. And it's been pointed out that a number of other people who were strong supporters of the war did everything possible to get out of the military. Mm-hmm. But that hasn't hurt anybody. In fact, I think that Dick Cheney said something like, well, I did what I thought was right for the country.
Right. I had other priorities, I think he may have said. Yeah.
We began by playing Born in the USA, and you tell the story about George Will going to see Bruce Springsteen in his Born in the USA tour. What was his response?
Yeah, it's kind of a hilarious column of his. He ventures out in his trademark bow tie and blue blazer and joins the crowd and is delighted. He comes to the conclusion that that Bruce Springsteen is sort of the epitome of Americanism and patriotism, because they're and it's true, there were a lot of big Springsteen in that tour played in front of a big gigantic flag when he sang Born in the USA. Will loved his work ethic. And
he took off his shirt and looked manly, he said.
He looked manly. And Will even called the people at Reagan's reelection campaign, this was in 1984, and suggested that they try to get Springsteen to show up and a joint appearance alongside Reagan. Springsteen, of course, politely declined. After all, he was already, you know, well known as a critic of many of the things that policies that Reagan had instituted that he felt had hurt working class Americans.
Well, did George Will listen to the lyric of the song?
Apparently not. I mean, the chorus, of course, invites a reading that turns it into a kind of patriotic anthem if you don't really listen to the lyrics. And to this day, I think there are a lot of people who hear it that way, and you can sometimes hear it played at 4th of July picnics and ball games and things. But the lyrics themselves are one of the sort of harshest condemnations of working class life you could ever come across. I mean, born down in a dead man's town, first kick I took was when I hit the ground, you know, sit off to this foreign land. It's really a story about a homeless and lonely and sort of defeated Vietnam vet.
How much have we been influenced by all of the movies and the other aspects of the popular culture since? You talk about how Apocalypse Now compares with Rambo, for example, and what they say mm-hmm. about the American consciousness.
Well, in general, I think what happens in the decades after the war is that the culture as a whole turns that experience, that really extraordinary decades-long experience, into an American tragedy, which allows us to think less and less about what we did in and to Vietnam and more about our own suffering, in particular the suffering of our veterans. So the stories that are often told in those movies really reduce it to a small unit of American troops going into this very hostile and savage environment, and then in turn possibly being a bit savage themselves. But we're really seeing it through their eyes, and our empathies are mostly with them and really not thinking so much about the consequences in Vietnam.
They are made more savage in the way that Lord of the Flies kids are made more savage by the circumstances,
right,
that
circumstances
they're contending with. You also talk about how Munich has been used over the years since Munich to inspire U.S. involvement in foreign wars. Was it used in Vietnam? Because I remember hearing a lot about it when Saddam Hussein's name was being brought up before the invasion of Iraq.
Right. It's a synonym for surrender, really, or weakness or appeasement and not standing tough to aggression. And it certainly was important in the early years of the Vietnam War, and it reappears periodically even beyond Vietnam. But one point I'd like to make is that it's worth remembering that policymakers by the mid-60s really no longer cared so much about keeping Vietnam free of communism. When you look at the internal once classified documents, the way they talk to each other in the Johnson administration is the main reason that we need to continue to escalate the war and prevent a communist takeover is for one reason, and that is to avoid humiliation, that this would be an intolerable blow to our international prestige, that we would be seen as weak, as paper tigers, and that's why we have to stay on, even though internally we have very little confidence that we can achieve our objectives.
And Nixon pretty much was saying the same thing.
Well, afterwards. Nixon's a little different. I mean, I think Nixon at some point did think that he could prolong the war long enough, if not quite to win it, at least to sort of put a pack up, get a sort of decent interval between our departure and maybe an ultimate defeat.
Weren't the people who warned of a domino, the domino theory, actually correct? Much of the area wound up becoming communist, at least for
Well, those three countries of Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam surely did, but it's worth noting that within a few years, they're at odds with each other. Vietnam invades Cambodia, and even the communist country to the north, China, and Vietnam engage in some very serious border conflict in the late 70s.
Do you see the controversy over American Sniper as a legacy of Vietnam?
You know, you see debates about almost anything that will elicit sort of Vietnam references, and I do think that the idea of focusing on the experiences of a single American and seeing the war through his eyes very much reflects a tendency in our culture that, above all else, we need to honor the service and sacrifice of our soldiers, and that's a way of really separating out and sometimes preventing a full debate about the missions they're sent to fight.
I'm going to end with a number of the questions that you propose here that continue to divide Americans in very deep ways. Should we continue to seek global military superiority? Can we use our power justly? Can we successfully intervene in distant lands to crush insurgencies or support them to promote democracy? What degree of sacrifice will the public bear, and who among us should bear it? And is it possible for American citizens and their elected representatives to change our nation's foreign policy? Do you think any of those questions will be answered in the near future?
I sure hope so. That's really what we need, a real public debate, which is not yet happening.
Christian G. Appy's latest book is American Reckoning, The Vietnam War and Our National Identity. It's published by Viking. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks so much for having me.